Hello, it's Tuesday, 13th of July. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up in the programme, I'll be talking to Mary-Anne Seacart about her fascinating new book, The Authority Gap. Also, the Amber List. Britain's rapid rise in COVID cases means we've now got a higher rate of infection in all but two of 140 countries on our Amber travel list. Does this mean now other countries are going to place restrictions on us going abroad? Three players who missed those spot kicks have been subjected to deeply offensive and unacceptable racist abuse on social media. How can the government do more to stop this happening? But first, we're looking at Boris Johnson confirming most restrictions will be lifted, but it's going to be up to people whether they wear a mask or not. Should the government be clearer in what it wants us to do? So Boris Johnson finally confirmed that most restrictions are to be axed on Monday, so-called Freedom Day, but called for continued mask wearing in busy indoor settings such as trains, supermarkets and cinemas. But does the government need to do more to reassure people and help them cope with their fear of the coronavirus? I'm joined now by Professor Robert Dingwall, who's Professor of Sociology at Nottingham Trent University. Professor, most people seem to be saying the messages coming out of government are mixed, and perhaps it would have been easier for the Prime Minister to say the mask rule on public transport and in closed spaces will stay in place.
Well, I think we're really at a point of transition where COVID is no longer the sort of catastrophic threat that it was thought to be early last year, but is the sort of mild illness that most of us will get from time to time, will keep coming round. And I think any restrictions, any advice, any guidance have to be proportionate to that. We really have to apply the test to them. Would we have done this for influenza in 2019? And if we would not have done, then we shouldn't be doing them now. Now, the thing about public transport is, of course, the conditions vary immensely throughout the day. So if you want a credible rule, you end up with a very uneven application, and it undermines confidence in the rule. The London Underground at 8 o'clock in the morning is quite different from the London Underground at 8 o'clock in the evening. And anything that is put out there should properly reflect that, and that's really what the shift from rules to guidance is calculated to achieve.
Yeah, do you think by making it guidance rather than the rules, the Prime Minister is reflecting the fact that perhaps many people now, Professor, are just fed up to the back teeth of all this? They see COVID infections rate are increasing dramatically, but see that the death rate is not increasing dramatically. In fact, nothing like dramatically.
Well, that's right. The nature of the threat from COVID has changed quite dramatically over the last 16 months. And in a largely vaccinated population, I mean, 90% of us have detectable antibodies, whether from vaccination or prior infection. The conditions are completely different. The nature of the illness is completely different. Even even going into hospital is a very different experience. The hospitals are not filling up with desperately ill people in the way that they were in January. The sort of people who are going in now go in for a few days for extra support with breathing, for access to treatments that can't be given in the community, and then they go out again. They're not progressing to intensive care. They're not people who are filling up hospital beds for weeks on end. So I think we have to make that adjustment. And what I think the government and their advisors are trying to do is to use the summer period to negotiate a reasonably soft landing by September, when we can go about our daily business much as we might have done in 2019. I think there is further to go on that, but I think what we're seeing here is a good start.
Yeah, and do you think the government is doing enough to make people more confident about going out now? I mean, the Prime Minister is not compelling people to go back to work, but the formal don't go into the office, that guidance has now been that has been dropped. And so it's up to, again, employers and employees. Do you think the government's doing enough to encourage people to feel that they can now lead a more freer life?
Well, I think the challenge now is dealing with the legacy of fear and anxiety that's built up over the last 16 months. And I really think the messaging, if the government really is using smart behavioural science advice, the messaging really needs to switch now to saying this is essentially safe rather than this is essentially risky, and concentrating on all of the things that we can be doing which have little or no risk attached to them. So anything that goes on out of doors, understanding that quite a lot of the measures that were adopted early last year really don't have much of a scientific basis, and that includes the mask wearing, and can quite safely be let go. And I think rather than focusing on, here are the bits that are still really dangerous, the thrust of the message should be, these things are safe, go out and do them.
Interesting. Can I ask you just finally, personally, Professor, what would be your view about the mask? Because this seems to be the great debating point. If you were to go on a train or a bus or a coach, would you wear a mask?
I think it would be very unlikely. I think I would only ever consider it in if I were travelling at rush hour. Let's say, in the supermarket on Christmas Eve. But the practical benefit of mask wearing for anybody is very small. And in a fully vaccinated population, I'm 71, I really see that I wouldn't derive any benefit from it, and I wouldn't protect anybody else by doing it. And I think my own position is that I would not wear a mask in most circumstances. I would not consider wearing a mask. I mean, I wouldn't wish to stop anybody else from reaching a different conclusion. But I would not voluntarily do it myself.
Very interesting. That was Robert Dingwall, Professor of Sociology at Nottingham Trent University. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The three black players, Marcus Rashford, Jadon Sancho and Bukayo Saka, who missed penalties against Italy in that extraordinary football final the other day, have predictably been swamped with racist messages on their social media pages. Social media companies are now facing calls to do more to tackle abuse, but privacy campaigners, open rights groups have said the government should do more to ensure that the police and the justice system use their existing powers. Jim Killick is the executive director of Open Rights Group. Jim, what can the government do to enable the police to try to get to grips with this problem?
I think most of this is actually a matter of training more than anything else. The police have powers to ask Twitter for the details of people who have social media accounts. You can match those details with who somebody is on their BT line and so on. It's a little bit technical, but not very technical. It's extremely well used in crime investigations. The problem is it isn't used when these kind of social media problems arise, because the police often don't know how to respond. They don't know the powers they have, the techniques available. They probably don't have the resources available to process this. So at the moment, it's extremely easy actually to find somebody on social media, to get hold of their email, to work out who they are, and ultimately take them to court. If a handful of these people were taken to court, I'm pretty sure that would be dissuasive to lots of their so-called mates. So that's what they should do. And the idea that the social media company should deal with it alone, or be the main way this is dealt with, I think that's actually not the right way to tackle it. And there's two reasons why. firstly, the people go unpunished, right? The people who are doing this are not punished. And the second thing then is that actually there's no dissuasion and it just carries on. And these people just do it again. They have their accounts deleted. They realize they're never actually going to be punished, so they just do it again. So it doesn't solve anything. Trying to get the social media to solve it doesn't actually solve the problem.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because people listening to this will be, I think, taken aback to hear that the police already have the powers to say to these companies, hand over the information. There's clearly been a decision taken in the past to do nothing about it, because these young men, Rashford, Sancho and Saka, have been subjected to racist abuse for many years.
Yeah, and I think this has been an ongoing problem for many, many years. There have been women who've suffered abuse online, who've gone to police stations, said, can you do something about this? I'm threatened, I'm worried, I want to know that this is being dealt with. And the police have said, yeah, well, it's social media, isn't it? What can I do? Nothing. That's the kind of response they tend to get. And then nothing does happen. In this particular case, I imagine, because it's so high profile,
yes. Yeah,
it is quite possible that I would expect the police to do something about it. Hopefully that will result in, a range of things happening, from cautions to people who are the least offenders through to prosecutions of the people who perhaps reach a sufficient criminal threshold. I think it is a surprise, because the government constantly tells everybody that nothing can be done. They need the online safety bill in order to solve the problem. But as I say, I don't think it does solve the problem, because the online safety bill is asking the companies to delete content, and that is not punishing people.
No,
it's just
quite
causing inconvenience at best.
What if these social media companies, Jim, play hardball here and actually don't cooperate with the police? Could they then end up in court too?
Yeah, they would. I mean, it's really, really unlikely that they would play hardball for several reasons. Firstly, they would be in breach of the law. If the police make a request for the details of a user, that is a legal compulsion, right? The company isn't allowed to refuse to do that. Mm. It must do it. The police are then held to account by other bodies to make sure that they're not doing this kind of, just because they feel like it. There are checks on that that we campaigned for many, many years, because we were concerned about the potential privacy abuse. But the fact is, these powers exist, and the companies really cannot resist those requests, and they don't, and particularly not the large platforms where this abuse is taking place, because they want to make sure that they do cooperate with the police. So I think a lot of this is about resource and training, basically.
Sure. The police, the abusive messages, the social media giants, Facebook, Twitter, said that they acted quickly and they got it all down within 10 hours. Why would it have taken so long? Particularly bearing in mind it was inevitable, in my view, the moment those lads missed those penalties, I thought, oh God, they're going to be swamped with racist abuse. If I thought that, the social media giants, there must be somebody in their organisations who would think the same. Why didn't they get rid of it within minutes or hours?
Well, I think, it is possible that they were just somewhat badly prepared, but I think, they do have to look at the content and check it and remove it, because they need to check that that's done at the threshold that the terms and conditions are being abused. And of course, if they were only taking things down because people were, kind of expressing their anger and disappointment, then I think you'd have people like me breathing down their necks as well. But at any rate, I think, removal of the material is just so, so not the point here.
I get that.
I'm
with you. I think they should bring back the stocks and lock these, put these people in the street, and we throw rotten vegetables at them because they're appalling people. I mean, football's supposed to be the beautiful game. It's horrible.
It is horrible. I think the thing with people saying things is people will say things which are wrong, vile, threatening, unpleasant. And in some sense, they have the right to try that. And we shouldn't be in a position where you can't do it at all. And the point is that when people go past a certain point and it turns into something which is, you know, genuinely threatening, putting people more than just being uneasy, but actually fearing for the consequences themselves, when people are trying to stir up other people into violence and so forth, this is where the criminal law needs to step in. And we can also consider people who are just kind of serial harassers, serial abusers, and think about whether there should be sort of lesser penalties around people who are just simply constantly unpleasant as a sort of hobby. But I think, you know, we need to kind of focus on the individuals who do this rather than thinking that the platforms are going to solve the problem by, you know, hitting the delete button.
Very interesting. That's Jim Killick. He's the executive director of Open Rights Group. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and lots more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryboyPierce. Britain's rapid rise in COVID cases means it now has a higher rate of infections than all but two of the 140 countries on our own amber travel list, where travellers are forced to quarantine on arriving in the UK. Only Cyprus and Fiji are currently suffering bigger outbreaks, according to surveillance data. What does it all mean? I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's travel editor, Mark Palmer. Mark, the worry is going to be that some of these countries are now going to put restrictions on British tourists.
That could well be the case, Andrew. I think that we're in one of those situations of one step forward and yeah, two steps back. These things come down to a matter of judgment. And in the same way that domestically here, the Prime Minister and his advisers have to make the judgment as to whether on Monday we can go back to a completely normal life. It seems that that's the way we're going, while at the same time infections and hospitalizations are going to be rising. So that's the problem that we've got. But then that is the problem that many of these other countries have got as well. But I think we should also remember that these are countries that rely so heavily, a lot of them, on tourism. And so that's the judgment they're going to have to make.
I'm thinking Spain in particular. The Prime Minister has been very clear. He wants British tourists. And when Mrs. Merkel, the German Chancellor, Mark, tried to persuade EU countries to repel British tourists, they effectively, the Greek governments and the Spanish government, said, on your bike.
Absolutely. And now it looks like Germany could go on our green list on Thursday. Germany, Italy and Austria are the sort of favourites, muted to be going on our green list, which is quite a turnaround if you think that Germany were the ones that were saying they didn't want us. So what will they do once they are on the green list? But obviously the rate of infections in the UK, when you look at it sort of from a figures point of view, it's profoundly worrying. And if you're any of those countries you mentioned, you're going to be thinking, is that a risk? Is that too great a risk for us to take?
Yeah, quite. I'm just looking. Daily cases, number of cases in the UK have increased since the end of June, doubling from just over 200 new cases per million people a day.
Absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about this today, though, that it's also the case, isn't it, that those people who are getting COVID-19 now, if they have been jabbed, and particularly if they've been double jabbed, that their symptoms are nothing like as severe as they were, you know, 12 months ago. And so while that is the case, and while we are reasonably confident that the jabs are actually kind of dealing with these variants, well, then I suppose we have to take the view that we've got to keep travelling, we've got to keep trying to open up the economy. Otherwise, we're going to be in terrible trouble.
What about France, Mark? Because there's been quite a lot of bad feeling between the British Prime Minister and the French President over Brexit, over Northern Ireland and Northern Ireland protocols. But a lot of British Tories go to the south of France for their holidays. How likely do you think it is that perhaps they may impose some restrictions?
I don't think they will. I think that when it comes down to it, the French are going to be quite pragmatic about it, and I think that quite soon we're going to see that France opening up, so many Britons want to be able to go over to France. In particular, I've noticed today that some of the ferry companies are lowering their rates, trying to prepare for that moment when people don't have to even get on a plane. They just get on a ferry and go over to France. Interesting, I think it was the French ambassador who was very much making the point that there's that the hard line that France has taken up until now has got nothing to do, of course, with any
of course
of the,
not.
Any of the,
no, getting no. Back oh, on. Oh, what? Perish the thought that Monsieur Macron could be motivated by spite and being peevish.
No, absolutely. I mean, the politics of it is fascinating, isn't it? And you'd know this better than me. And to see that these little sort of infightings that are going on still sort of left over from our exit from the EU.
And what of people who want to book a holiday now, Mark? They see their country, the country they prefer, is on the amber list. They'll still be worried that things change and they suddenly go on to a red list, in which case they then be into all sorts of difficulties when they get back, quarantining for 10 days and very expensive tests.
Yeah, I think we're looking at two different kinds of traveller at the moment, Andrew. I think that there are those people, and probably in the majority, who are thinking it's too much of a hassle, it's too expensive, the paperwork, as I know for myself when I went out recently to Lisbon, it's terribly complicated. And so a lot of people, they're thinking to themselves, well, we're just going to give it a miss this year. There are other people who actually are quite savvy about where to go and get a test. They're quite good online, filling in their forms and everything else, particularly perhaps younger people. And they're thinking, well, this is actually a golden opportunity. There's some great deals out there. Mm. You can go to Florence or wherever, and you won't have to be queuing in a line to get into these great galleries and things like that. And so they see it as an opportunity.
Yeah. Just remind people, so who are listening, what they do have to do if they do choose to go to Spain or a country that's on the amber list, not on the green list. What do they have to do?
Well, I don't know how long you've got, Andrew, because each country is different. That's the point.
Yeah.
But in the majority of cases, the big change is that the amber countries, you can go to an amber country and it's like going to a green country, in that when you come back, you don't have to go into quarantine. That is the big change from our side. But then from other countryside, most countries are insisting that you have a PCR test up to 72 hours before you leave. You then go to on holiday, and then 72 hours before coming back, then you have to take a test. For us coming back into the UK, you have to take another test.
Yes.
That can be a rapid flow test. And then when you come back into the UK on day two, I think it is, that you then have to take another PCR test. So at the moment, with not all, but with most countries, there are three tests involved.
Right.
And those are roughly going to cost you around sort of £70 or £80. They're coming down a bit, times three.
Yes.
So, you know, it's
still very expensive.
It's
a family.
It's expensive if you're a family.
And what about the locator forms people have to fill in? Are these very complicated?
They're not terribly complicated, because the airlines have been quite good at helping you. They won't give you your boarding pass until you've uploaded your passenger locator form. And so when you get to the airport, the idea is you won't suddenly think, oh, I haven't got my passenger locator form, because you won't have actually gone to the airport, or
yes,
you went to
got your. And where do you get the passenger locator? Where do you get the locator form from?
Well, if you your
when you,
your,
when you book your
when you,
flight
when you book your flight, and then they will they tell you EasyJet or British Airways actually makes it quite easy. You just click on this locator form, you fill in the details, you upload it to your My Bookings, whatever it is, and then you print it out as a safeguard. But when you go, then automatically it shows up. When you just put in your details.
Very interesting. Where are you going, Mr. Travel Editor, for your holiday?
Well, I'm actually going to Mallorca, but
lovely.
not until September. And I was going to take a villa, got quite a good deal on a large villa, going with children and even grandchildren, dare I say it. They keep changing the flight times. That's apparently something which is happening, because these airlines are having this trouble moving their fleet around the world.
Sure.
But at the moment, I'm waiting until towards the end of September.
All right, that's Mark Palmer, the Daily Mail's very fine travel editor. Thanks for joining us. Time now for our regular city update with Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. Now, Ruth, you have been writing some great stuff about Greensill. This is the company that David Cameron was lobbying all sorts of people, senior civil servants, cabinet ministers, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, to try to see if there could be government money, because he didn't want this company to go under. We now know how much he was being paid. £29,000 a day or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. So he was paid more than $1 million by Greenshill a year. So he was only contracted to work 25 days a year. So that works out at about $40,000 per day, or as you correctly said, around £26,000, which Amazing. Is quite nice work if you can get it, considering
Certainly is.
As he would have known when he was Prime Minister, that's not too far away from the average full-time wage of somebody per year, not per day, obviously.
Yes, quite.
That is quite a shocker. I mean, of course, he's going to be competing with George Osborne, who's just got himself a posh job at Robey Warshaw, which is an important boutique bank, or even Nick Clegg, who he rather patronised when Nick Clegg was the deputy. And Nick Clegg, of course, has got this very lucrative position at Facebook. So maybe he felt he had to compete with his former colleagues. He was, of course, in line for a huge payout on share options on Greenshill,
yes.
if it
yeah.
hadn't all gone horribly wrong, which it has. So, you know, it could have been even more of a big payday for him than it actually was. But I suspect people are going to be furious about this.
Of course they are. And just remind me, Ruth, what Greenshill did, because Cameron brought the guy behind Greenshill into the Cabinet Office when the Tories were in government. Most odd for a businessman who was appealing for government contracts to get a job in the Cabinet Office.
Very, very, very odd scenario. You're quite right. So what Greenshill does is it specialises in supply chain finance. So it's basically paying invoices sooner than they're actually due at a discount. It's a sort of perfectly normal thing to do in business, but Greenshill did it on a grand scale and were practically the only source of finance, as far as one can tell, for the Gupta Steel empire. What's quite interesting about it is that they pretty much entirely fell through the regulatory net, so nobody was really looking at them. You're right, though, this is riddled with conflicts of interest. Lex Greenshill, who is the founder of the firm, he's an Australian chap, named it after himself, obviously very modest. He managed to unveil himself as an advisor to the government at the same time as he was obviously running this company. Clear conflict of interest. It was an unpaid advisory role in Whitehall, but, you know, nevertheless. There was also a big issue around a chap called Bill Crothers, who was a bigwig civil servant in the Cabinet Office. He was in charge of procurement, and he was also an advisor at Greenshill. Again, very, very unorthodox, to say the least. Now, what's happened, another thread in this very tangled story, is that the Constitution Affairs Committee and Public Administration Committee of MPs wanted to call a lady called Sue Gray in front of them as part of their investigation into Greenshill. She's a former government ethics chief, and she was in charge when Greenshill was appointed as a government advisor. Now, Michael Gove blocked her from appearing. Now, he said he would appear himself, but it's just very rum. Why has he blocked her from appearing? Why doesn't he want her to answer questions? The whole thing is very, very strange and very tangled. And I think the sooner somebody gets to the bottom of what exactly has gone on here, the better. But there's obviously some sort of red faces and some skeletons still waiting to come out of the cupboards.
And of course, this has done nothing for the reputation of David Cameron other than cause it, I think, almost terminal damage.
I think you're right. I think it's going to be very, you know, politics now, people do make astonishing comebacks. You know, we have seen it with people like Peter Mandelson, haven't we, where they've really made amazing bounce backs in their career. I think it's going to be hard for David Cameron to come back from this. I mean, not least because it's not only a conflict of interest that's very obvious, it's this kind of cringy nature of the text. And the emails that were sent,
I know.
It was really toe-curling. And also, the sheer lack of judgment. It was absolutely no secret in the city that there were concerns about Greenshill. So I think just the foolishness, the lack of judgment involved, that's quite hard to come back from that.
I think that's right. That's Ruth Sunderland, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. And you can expect a very large piece on Greenshill in tomorrow's Daily Mail. We'll be right back. Is it time we treated sexism in the same way we treat racism? The writer Marianne Seacott argues that women are still belittled and patronised by men. In her new book, The Authority Gap, she argues that all too often we assume men know what they're talking about until they're proved otherwise, while for women, it's the other way around. And she joins me now. Marianne, it's fascinating, the article you've written. How do you define the authority gap?
It's the extent to which we're still prepared to take men more seriously than women. And it's manifested by the sort of behaviour that pretty much all women have experienced, such as being underestimated, being talked over in meetings, being interrupted, being given just too little conversational time when they're talking to a man, having their expertise challenged, and basically having their authority questioned. And all these things happen very frequently to women, mainly by men, but not always. Women do it to other women too, because we've all been brought up with the same sort of old-fashioned traditional stereotypes baked into our brains.
You tell a great story, a great anecdote about the dinner where you were sitting next to a man just a little older than yourself who asked what you did. Can you describe that conversation?
Yes, so I felt it was slightly awkward because women aren't allowed to sound boastful in a way that men are. But I did actually at the time have quite a big portfolio of different jobs, and I didn't know which one would interest him most. So I said, well, I write a political column in The Independent, and I chair a think tank, and I sit on a couple of commercial boards, and I'm on the council of Tate Modern, and I do a bit of work for charity. And he said, well, you're a busy little girl. I was 50. I was older than the then prime minister.
It's outrageous, isn't it? Were you tempted, as you say, to spear him with your fork or to empty your glass of wine over his head?
That's what my Twitter followers suggested afterwards I should have done. I'm afraid I didn't. I just spluttered and said, God, I haven't been called a little girl since I was about 6, and I remember it infuriating me even then. He didn't get it, though. He didn't see why this was in any way insulting or belittling.
You've had big, powerful jobs. You had a huge job on the Times newspaper for many years, Marianne. Do you see that it's changed at all for the good of women, or is it still as bad?
Oh, no, it's definitely got better. It has definitely got better. And there are many more women in senior jobs now than there were, but still many too few. You know, if you look at the 100 biggest companies in Britain, only 6 are run by women and 94 by men. So there's still some way to go. But the point I'm making is that a lot of people think, oh, it's all fine now because it's better than it used to be.
Yeah.
And actually, most women discover that just in their everyday interactions, it still isn't fine. You know, if they're standing with a man at a party or something and people come up to talk to them, they will always address the man before the woman. Things like that, that just sort of remind you every day that you are treated as just that little bit inferior.
And you also make the very important point, I think, particularly in this modern socially and media driven age, that the authority gap can be a serious hazard. Women 27 times more likely to be abused online than men.
That's right. And that really, it was the most distressing chapter I had to write, was the backlash against women having any sort of voice. Now, we all know how women in public life are hugely more abused online than men. You know, politicians and journalists and people like that suffer a lot more abuse, and really not just abuse, but really scary things like rape threats and death threats. But what really shocked me was that even women and girls completely out of the public eye suffer this as well. So, you know, you can have a 13-year-old girl putting up a little video on YouTube about how to braid her hair, and she'll get rape threats in the comment section. It's just horrible.
Of course, we had that Ofsted review which found sexual harassment is now a routine part of life for British school children. I'm pretty sure when I was at school, Marianne, it wasn't a problem. Maybe it was and I didn't notice. Do you think that is a new phenomenon?
I think it's more likely to be the latter, Andrew, because we don't notice these things unless they happen to us. I mean, I remember it happening at school, 40-odd years ago, because that's how old I am.
Yeah.
I think it might have got worse. I think it might have got worse because of porn. And, you know, all the horrible, degrading things that are done to women on porn that boys as young as 11 or 12 see on their phones. So I think that, you know, we didn't get that when we were at school. And I think that gives them a version of femininity which can be really damaging to their female classmates.
What is the answer? Is there a simple solution to this? I mean, apart from men changing their behaviour.
if they're a simple one, we'd have sold it by now. I've put 140 solutions at the back of the book just to try to show that we can change this, but it's in lots of very small ways. And the thing is that the authority gap is an accumulation of little disadvantages, small snubs, really, that women receive over the course of a day, a week, a lifetime, but cumulatively add up to an enormous discrepancy between the way they're treated and the way men are treated. And so we've got to change all those small interactions. And the most important thing, actually, is for us all to acknowledge that we're biased. I'm biased against women, and I've written a whole book about it. But I still sometimes find myself listening to perhaps a youngish woman with a high voice on the radio being interviewed, and maybe she sounds a bit childish in a way that men can't, you know, because their voices break. And I'll think, oh, I wonder if she knows what she's talking about. And I'll say to myself, stop it. Just listen to the content of what she's saying and then judge. So I think we all just have to acknowledge that however intelligent or liberal or even female we are, we probably have this unconscious bias, and it's called unconscious for a reason. But let's try and notice when it then manifests itself and try to correct for it.
So we've got to persuade boys somehow, Mary-Anne, as you say, to regard girls not as potential sexual conquest, but as fully rounded intellectual equals or even intellectual betters.
Yes. Well, not just, but of course they're going to think of them as potential sexual conquest if they're teenage boys. But more than that, yes, please. You know, fully rounded people and intellectual equals, that'll do me.
All right, that's Mary-Anne Seacart, who's the author of a fascinating new book, which is out now, published by Doubleday, and it's called The Authority Gap. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.